Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I could see it in her eyes when we met. I've got to stop sweating. Oh, she looked at my hairline. She thinks I'm bald. She's thinking I would never in a million years sleep with this guy.
We think you're great.
Oh, thanks. Wow, that's nice to hear.
To begin, coffee would help me think. Coffee and a muffin.
I'm going up to Santa Barbara this Saturday, and I was wondering...
Oh.
I'm sorry.
So I'll just be right back with your pie then.
Drum roll, please. I'm gonna be a screenwriter, like you.
I'm putting in a chase sequence. So the killer flees on horseback, cops after them on a motorcycle. And it's like a battle between motors and horses, like technology versus horse.
Hello and welcome to Rewatchability, the podcast where we rewatch old movies to see if they hold up over time. My name is Blaine Waters. With me as always is...
Robert LaRonde.
And...
Jay McNabb.
And joining us for this podcast are the hosts of What About Meryl, Danita and Emily.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
That's great. And before we start the podcast, we just want to quickly shout out to our sponsors, Endy Mattress and HelloFresh. And thank you to our Patreon subscribers, those who give us $1, $3, $5 a month. Thank you very much for helping us out.
You're like our ghost orchids.
Yeah, relatively hard to find. Yeah.
And when you donate and become our ghost orchid, you get like great things like the podcast early.
Yeah.
At a certain level, you get like the classic episodes.
Mysterious green drugs.
Yeah. Real high.
We perform dial tones for you. It's a real plus. So this week on Rewatchability, we rewatched Adaptation because it stars Meryl Streep, which you guys are an expert in.
Yes, I like to hope so.
I mean, yeah, by now we've done like 35 of her movies on the podcast. So
right.
I would say, you know, if anybody knows about Meryl,
yeah, podcast it might be PhD.
Us. Yeah.
Or possibly her friends and family.
Yeah. Maybe them, maybe her
husband. It's like her
aunt.
Kids and then you.
Yeah, exactly. We pretty much are her kids.
Mamie
now.
Doesn't even know her that well.
No, I don't think so. But I feel like we've learned so much about Meryl over time, and she's got a lot of movies that maybe aren't your style of movies, like, you know.
That's an assumption.
I've listened to your podcast, and I feel like, you know, Bridges of Madison County wouldn't be your top choice, Mamma Mia wouldn't be your top choice, but this movie, to me... seems like a choice you guys would like. I'm very curious to see what you guys think of this movie.
Well, you know, one of our earliest episodes was Death Becomes Her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You guys
right.
did.
Yes.
Yeah. That was, well, I think we all liked that.
Yeah. For sure.
It's yeah.
a great one.
Yeah. It was a fascinating. I wanted to do Bridges of Madison County because I watched that with my mom when I was younger.
So cute.
And I wanted to see all that. But you guys had never watched it.
No, I think it was because that was one that like my parents liked so much when I was a kid. That's how I rebelled as a teenager by saying I'll never watch that movie.
Right.
Or any movie about bridges.
Yeah.
Bridge over the River Kwai.
Nope.
And now Clint Eastwood has gone crazy, so now I just don't want to watch it.
Oh my God. Right. Guys, just like look up the gif of him like in the rain. Like there's like this really dramatic moment where it's supposed to be really romantic and he's like sopping wet and his like barely there hair is like sticking
it's
to
so
his face.
Just like three strands of it.
Yeah. It's horrifying. So
that was as vulnerable as a man could be back then.
I suppose.
What, to like admit his coma?
Standing in the rain. That's all.
Okay.
So, using an umbrella.
Okay, so let's go around and talk about the first time we saw Adaptation, Rob.
I saw it in university. My university girlfriend was in the film studies program at York. She took classes with JM. And so she, like, imparted me, like, a lot of, like, you know, really cool film knowledge and, like, introduced me to, like, a lot of auteurs and people that, you know, that I've since sort of, like, taken as, like, inspiration. And,
like Spike Jonze.
Yeah, like Spike Jonze for sure, actually, or Charlie Kaufman in particular. And so I remember she had the script, the published script version of Adaptation and a VHS cassette. So I read and watched it back to back.
Did you do it at the same time, like those like read-along with a tape books?
Yeah.
The kids?
Yeah.
When you hear Charlie Kaufman groan, turn the page. Oh.
I don't want to turn the page when he does that.
But so I really loved this movie, and also, like, as, you know, an aspiring writer, I really took it to heart because it's a movie about the existential complexities of creation and how hard it is to write shit. So
the first part was really eloquent.
But I also recognize that in ways, like, it's not a great movie. Like, it's not my favorite Charlie Kaufman movie. Like, it seems to fall apart in the end, I always thought. But so I was definitely excited to rewatch it.
What about you, Jim?
I feel like our two stories are going to be kind of similar because we saw it at the same screening before we knew each other. Well, do you want to explain what it was?
It was like a pre-screening for the film that they had at U of T.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. In its college.
I didn't go to U of T, but they gave out passes to like a bunch of local film schools. Mm-hmm. So it was it was Charlie Kaufman, Nicolas Cage, and Spike Jonze.
Yeah, we're all there watching the movie with us, which was really cool.
Wow. Yeah, but then I don't know if they were like still editing it or whatever, because they sort of did an hour afterwards where they were like asking the kids questions about the movies. Like, did you get this? Did you like this?
Yeah,
that kind
the kids
of thing.
Got it. It was the older people that were like, why did the third act fall apart? He's like, okay.
Wait, are you that man?
No, a lot of people, were very kind of like got pretty hostile about the ending of the
movie.
And
no one asked Nicolas Cage a question. Oh, my friend. No, anyway, I'll tell that story. But,
yeah. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, that's my only thing. And actually, I accidentally asked Siri something.
Siri, what did you think of Adaptation?
But I always kind of felt like I wish I had said something during the Q&A part because I liked the ending and I thought people were being a little unfair. But I think Spike Jonze kind of hung around for a bit afterwards. I think I told him that when I got him to sign like my a scrap of paper I'd written some notes on that day. I still have that somewhere.
Nice.
So, Blaine, tell me your experience. You were at the same screening.
Yeah, I was at the same screening. It was a very different experience. It was a very weird experience. My friend took me, and I didn't have a pass, so we were just standing in line in hopes to get a pass to see it because I was obsessed with Charlie Kaufman. And yeah, it was a weird experience. It was the first time. So I don't know if I should tell the story on the podcast, but all right. So I left line to go to the washroom, and in this college is a hot spot for some activity. Sexual activity. Oh. So when I walked into the male washroom, there were two men making love. Oh. And I don't know if you call it making love in a washroom, but they were there, and I ran to the stall because I didn't really know what was happening, and I was like, oh, they'll leave because there's another person here, but then they just finished up while I was in the stall, and I felt a little awkward about that.
That made it hotter.
Yeah. And then I left, and I went upstairs, and my friend was like, we're going to go see this movie, and I was like, yeah. Like, I was just very out of myself.
You felt too worldly now. You've seen too much to watch some stuff.
Yeah, I was staring the distance a lot.
You're having all these questions.
Yeah.
This was also before, like, Grindr and Tinder and stuff, so presumably people had to be like, wait till Charlie Kaufman releases a movie, go to the pre-screening and meet me in the bathroom. And people would wait years for a rendezvous.
So romantic. Yeah.
I also felt bad because I don't know, I didn't want to... Like, I felt like, oh, like, this kid comes in, they're like, oh, this guy's going to judge us. So I wanted to say something because, like, my father figure was gay. So I was like, ah, oh, this is cool, guys. But then I was also like, I'm going to ruin the moment if I say anything.
Right.
So I didn't. Yeah, it was
what
a complex.
A conundrum.
Yeah, it was a complex moment in my life that now that everyone knows. Anyway, then I went back up.
If you could say anything to those two guys, what would you say?
You know, I hope you found what you were looking for, you know, out there. In the distance. No, so then I went back up, and my friend that was with me, he got in, And then I got into like standing room only, which was really cool. So I still saw the movie. And then he asked the only question of Nicolas Cage, who was biting their fingernails?
There was someone. Oh, yeah, it was Nick Cage.
It was Nick Cage. Who was I was gnawing on his fingers and spinning it on the ground with people sitting in front of
him. I was sitting on the ground. I told you that. Because I was late, so I had to sit on the floor. And yeah, they were sitting right in front of me. He was biting his nails and spitting
them. Oh, my God.
Which, so gross.
I was like, is he still in character? Like, why is he doing this?
Yeah.
Is there like, will that unlock like one of Thomas Jefferson's riddles or something if he spits his nails on the ground? I don't know.
Oh, but, man. Yeah. It was so gross.
Yeah, it was kind of gross.
Yeah, my friend asked me a question because no one asked him a question. Oh, yeah. And he was like, how did you prepare for Donald and for Charlie? And he was like, great question. And he just like launched into it. And he was like, so on coke. He was very like animated. So it was just a weird thing. And Charlie Kaufman hardly spoke. Right. He was very much himself. So it's a weird thing. When did you guys first see Adaptation?
Yeah, top that.
Yeah.
Do you want to go first? You know what? I don't even remember specifically, but I will guess that I rented it from VideoFlix. Mm.
What's a video store?
It's a video store
okay. In
North York, I guess. It's on Avenue Road. I used to go there all the time with my dad, and I would rent like 7 movies for the week. It was like 7 movies for $10 or something.
That VideoFlix sale is getting a lot of plugs in the show.
Well, I talked about it.
You tweeted Alex.
Well, Emily and I talk about VideoFlix all the time because we didn't know each other then, but we both went there all the time. So we for sure were like 2 passing ships as young ones.
You were probably secretly angry at each other for taking out the same Meryl
probably, Streep. Probably. 100%. But
this Sophie's choice.
Yeah. Well, this movie came out around the same time that The Hours came out. And I saw The Hours in theaters, and I was like 13, and I loved it so much. And that was kind of which is so weird, like at 13 to love The Hours, but I did. And that sort of kickstarted my like Meryl obsession and sort of like renting all of her films, and Adaptation was definitely like one of the ones that I rented, and I remember liking it a lot. And then I don't have any specific memories of
when you saw Meryl,
yeah,
she's in a completely feels like different role. Like did that
you know what, I think we talked about this when we did Adaptation on What About Meryl, but I think more than relating to Meryl when I first saw it, I really, because when I was younger, I was wanting to be a writer, and I've always been sort of like a neurotic type. So I think I really, like Charlie's character just really resonated with me. And and also too, I think around when I was 13, 14 was when I was really, like, I've always loved movies, but at that age I was like, okay, I'm going to like get into film. And so I think this sort of fit into that for me as well.
Right.
So I think it just sort of felt like one of the first like films that I had ever seen, you know, that had a lot of layers, and you know, Spike Jonze, and
there was something to get.
Yeah,
like, as a viewer, you were like, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah,
cool. What about you?
I don't have a cool story at all about this movie. I watched it for the first time and fell asleep, so that's my big story. And that was just like, I probably rented it from VideoFlix. I rented it and I watched it in my basement and then I fell asleep. And I think it's just because like I'm just a sleepy person and I fell asleep. I don't remember it being like, I hate this movie. I'm out, you know? Like I just fell asleep and I didn't finish it. So I only saw like the first 20, 30 minutes. So like the ending when I rewatched it this year, I was like, what the? This movie is completely different than I thought.
Yeah.
So that was kind of cool when we rewatched it. And I absolutely loved it when I watched it this time because I just didn't think that Meryl had such an interesting role in it. I thought she was just like this writer and I was like, whatever. But she like gets to like be a badass and is like, I guess we should kill him, and like all this stuff that we never get to see Meryl do.
Right.
Because she never gets to kill.
She doesn't get to kill enough.
And, yeah.
But so I thought it was like a really cool turn for her. And I mean, like I don't know if I related to Charlie Kaufman in the same way that you did, but like I just thought she was such a badass, and I was like, man, I just want to take off. Like, I know that Chris Cooper's got some missing teeth in it, but like I would take off with him.
You know? He's amazing. He has charisma. You don't need teeth if you
have
teeth.
And the reason he doesn't have teeth is kind of sad. So
it means a lot.
It's not just like meth.
No, exactly.
If you judge him when it is revealed, you feel bad for him.
Oh yeah,
exactly.
You feel bad.
Yeah, it's such good writing. Yeah, it's
amazing. Yeah, so, and they're like, I don't know, I think Meryl is like really sexy in this movie, and I wanted to get you guys, like, what was your opinion on
it? Well, she has great hair. I know that much.
Well, yeah. That's true.
I think she's sexy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never been attracted to Meryl Streep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Not even young Meryl?
I don't think I've
seen Manhattan.
Oh, you would definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I
I've
don't
seen
know.
Manhattan. I just don't remember her in that. Yeah,
she's really
so beautiful.
Okay. She's stunning in it. Like she's got long hair.
Dissenting opinion. Okay.
I don't know. I just find her like, and we've watched a lot of her movies, and I think she's sexy in a lot of them. But I think this is like one of her sexiest because I feel like, especially the part when she's like on drugs, where she's like, very carefree and like you know, kind of
the toes come into frame.
Yeah. Very feeling herself. You know. Yeah.
No, I think she's so central in this movie, and I think what's so fascinating and amazing is that Spike Jonze kind of took this middle-aged woman and like the camera lingers on her, and the camera makes her sensual, and I just think that's so radical of Spike Jonze, and I that's what I really love about this movie.
Yeah, there's a kind of like sexual longing in her character 100%. The whole way through. Yeah. Like, like those scenes you're talking about where she's like in bed and the camera just kind of like slowly pushes in on her.
It's not salacious or anything. Like, no, her nightgown is kind of done up and stuff, but like it does, it's very sensual. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the sexiest podcast we've ever done.
We get to see that Polaroid of her naked.
Oh, yeah, totally. Or well, totally her. Yeah.
It's got to be her.
100% her.
There's no technology which could stitch a head onto a body.
So do you want to give us the kind of rundown of the movie, Rob?
Yeah. Well, so it sort of starts with just darkness and a voiceover. And it's like, do I even have an original thought in my head? My bald head, my stupid head. And it's this neurotic voice, just like full of doubt and asking like what he needs, what he's looking for. He needs a girlfriend. He needs to learn Chinese. And then that would be a thing. He could write Chinese or something. And this is all just done in blackness with typewritten sort of titles.
And what kind of blew me away is that one of the titles is Jonathan Demme was one of the producers on this.
Yeah.
Which is totally crazy.
He was in the film business. It's not that crazy.
No, I know. But like, we did Silence of the Lambs a little while ago, and that's right. A completely
seems
different
well
movie.
Seems well-suited to me, actually.
Oh, yeah? Okay, sure.
But it's Charlie Kaufman, as portrayed here by Nicolas Cage. He's actually on the set of Being John Malkovich, sort of like cowering in the corner.
Yeah, it's documentary style.
Yeah, asking, you know, whether he should even be there, why he bothered to come, how he's in the way. Somebody says he's, you know, in the eye line and he has to move. This part's like really amazing, I thought, when I first saw it, because Being John Malkovich came out like literally like a year before this.
No, it was a few years. That was 99, I think, yeah.
Well, it seemed like very soon.
Yeah, yeah.
Still
yeah,
relatively.
Yeah, it was not that long.
And it was another Spike Jonze film, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I always got them mixed up because for the first four Charlie Kaufman movies, it was Michel Gondry and Spike Jonze. I can never remember which one did which.
It was Spike Jonze for the first two and then Michel Gondry for Eternal Sunshine.
And Human Nature, which wasn't very good.
Human Nature was Michel Gondry?
Yeah.
I thought it was Spike Jonze. Ah, okay.
But so he's a successful Hollywood writer. They're making his film and he has a meeting with his agent to adapt this book, Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief. And his agent is played by Tilda Swinton. I think you guys, when you're done with Meryl, because you said you're running out of movies, we talked about this, you should do a Tilda Swinton cast and you should call it Tilda Credits.
I like
oh, okay.
I like the pun.
That's my
pitch. Yeah.
I think you should start that podcast.
Yeah, you seem very passionate.
Was that stupid? It's a dumb idea. Oh, my God.
That would be a ride.
Why did I say that? I'll just delete it. But so he wants to make this movie. He's a writer with integrity. He wants to make it like he wants it to just exist and be. He doesn't want to put all this Hollywood convention cliche bullshit. He doesn't want to make it about drug trafficking. He doesn't want it to be sexy. He doesn't want it to have like a love interest.
He just wants a beautiful story about flowers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is nice.
Tilda Swinton's like, she sort of seems willing to let him run with it. He gets the assignment, but he's like paralyzed by his neuroses. Mm-hmm. Like things aren't so bad for him. He has like this girl who's interested in him, Amelia.
Yeah, he has a house in L.A.
He has a house in L.A., which, you know, he is sharing it with his brother, we find out.
Yeah, Donald. And he doesn't have any furniture.
Yeah.
That's weird.
But yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's supposed to show that he's kind of like out of money, but I don't know. It's also he has a house in L.A. I don't know.
You think he's supposed to be out of money?
I feel like he's supposed to be not well.
Yeah, I think he's just like so unorganized. And also like he like there's this feeling of like he doesn't deserve furniture.
Yeah,
He doesn't deserve furniture.
Sometimes.
Yeah, you only deserve to lay down.
Right.
Yeah.
So we get also intercut with this. We do get introduced to the Meryl Streep character, Susan Orlean. And mainly at the beginning, she's sort of telling the story of John LaRose. Roche, who is the Chris Cooper character, who is this sort of like mustached, front teeth missing, mulleted, like Florida hick.
Yeah. fun character. He's a fun character.
Yeah.
Well, he's great. He won an Oscar for this, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. And he sort of got in trouble for going into state protected land and cultivating all these plants and orchids. But he has his loop around is that he's doing with a bunch of Seminoles. I'm not going to say Indians because I don't know if that's politically correct.
Okay, you just said it, though.
Shit. Well, it says it twice.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But
it's a different time. It was the early 2000s.
And it's the character saying it.
And it took place years before because it's a flashback.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
It was really old.
But he's like, because he's with them and he doesn't actually touch them, he's legally allowed to do it. He's even like with the conservation officer, he's like, these plants, every one of them is endangered.
Yeah. I love the balls on him at that point. He's just like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm safe because I've done my like legal research.
Now, one thing, because I kind of watched this movie this time. I hadn't seen it in a while. I liked it the time I saw it. I didn't really mention that. But I was kind of watching it more through the lens of thinking about Meryl, because I know you guys were coming on the show and that's the reason why we're watching it. And I don't think I'd really appreciated before how they kind of parallel her and Charlie Kaufman. Like they show them writing like in conjunction with one another. I think they're kind of supposed to be... Charlie Kaufman's less the focus than I remembered. Mm-hmm. I think it's supposed to be they're kind of working in tandem. Is that what you guys got?
Yeah, definitely. For sure. And they only like have one scene together, I think, when they're like meeting in the office, right?
So, right, yeah. In the elevator.
Yeah. And so I think, yeah, they definitely are parallel stories. And I like personally, like I said before, like I really got lost in Susan's story because I was like, oh, she's a female writer that wrote this beautiful story. And then this guy is trying to adapt her story, you know?
Yeah.
And so, which I feel like is a very relatable thing for a lot of female writers. And I think that Meryl really like infuses like a lot of personality into Susan. And apparently Susan was like a little weirded out by the casting of Meryl, like the
really?
Real Susan.
Yeah. Why?
Yeah. Because like if you look at Susan, she looks nothing like Meryl. And I think like she just didn't understand why. Well, I would be like thrilled if Meryl Streep wanted to play
with
me. But, you know, whatever. But then she watched it and she was like, A, the Susan that she's playing is not me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
But it's like a wonderful interpretation of what Susan is or like what a female writer is, you know?
Yeah. It's called adaptation.
Yes. It's an adaptation. So, but yeah, what did you think of it?
Well, yeah, what's so interesting about the, for me, is the Susan Orlean situation is that when I first watched Adaptation, I didn't know anything about Susan Orlean. And in the years since, I've really gotten into her and I listened to her podcast, Cry Babies, which is
she has a podcast?
Yeah, her and Sarah Thayer have a podcast called Cry Babies and they have celebrities and like writers and comedians and stuff on and they talk about like the stuff that makes them cry. And it's so good.
Cool.
Like, shout out to Cry Babies.
Yeah.
We should have had her on the podcast. Yeah.
We already tried that. And then because we were doing Adaptation, I actually read The Orchid Thief. And it's just such a beautiful book. And she writes so beautifully. And it is... It does seem like impossible to adapt because she goes into, like, the history of orchids and talks about just so in-depth about orchids. And so it's... After reading the book, you're like, wow, I could totally see why Charlie Kaufman would be having a meltdown over how do you adapt this?
Yeah, because he says there's no narrative.
There's no narrative. Yeah. It's such a beautiful book, but there's no narrative. And I guess Susan Orlean actually didn't really want herself in the movie. I think a lot of writers are kind of behind the scenes. They don't want any attention.
Yeah, fair enough.
And she was like this, and after reading the screenplay, she was like, this is going to ruin my life. People are going to think I'm a drug addict.
Yeah, I was so surprised to hear that she was all right with the movie afterwards.
Yeah, after the fact.
I was reading a bit about it too because I was thinking about Meryl. And yeah, it sounds like she was, to be fair, like pretty even annoyed at first that like I heard she was even annoyed just that it wasn't going to be called The Orchid Thief.
Yeah, for sure. And also it just sort of like gave me like goosebumps when I heard about it. But I guess Susan Orlean, while she was writing this, The Orchid Thief, she was going through like a lot of sort of personal turmoil and a lot of like she was going through marital troubles and that sort of thing, which obviously is not mentioned at all in the book, The Orchid Thief. And so when she saw the movie, she was like, I cannot believe that Charlie Kaufman picked that up from my book.
That would be like, so...
Yeah. She was like, I hadn't talked about it publicly, and Charlie just made Susan in the movie this sad character. Like, one of the Seminoles, I think, actually says, like, you've such a sad...
A beautiful sadness.
Like, I think the answer's in the movie. He was following her around, watching her with binoculars.
Would not surprise me. He could go unnoticed for sure.
Yeah.
He's so little.
Yeah, that's another thing we didn't talk about is because I'd never seen Charlie Kaufman before we went to that thing. Mm. And in the movie, he's, you know, heavy set and awkward and balding. He wasn't like that at all. In real life, he's like little and kind of wiry. And he looked like...
He still has like curly hair and stuff.
But he had more hair.
Yeah, he had more hair.
And he kind of looked like Seth Green.
But I could see like Charlie Kaufman kind of in his head, like seeing himself.
Yeah.
Like and like how he looks in the movie.
For sure.
You know, like I don't think that's a.
Yeah. I also think it's one of those things that it's kind of like if I'm going to make fun of someone else or if I'm going to like put something on them, I'm going to put something on myself.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
So. He doesn't exactly write himself as a flattering character or even like as a hero.
No, he masturbates too much to be a hero.
I think that's also something.
Does that preclude you from being a hero?
I think that's also something Susan Orlean said was like, when she got the script and was reticent to do it, she was like, or the studio was saying, you know, it's not going to get made if you don't give it the okay, and everyone else is okay with it. And she also said something to the effect of, well, you know, like Charlie Kaufman kind of made himself the worst character of all. Yeah. So she went along with it.
Which is so rare for a man to do. So.
Yeah, usually we just do it in our own heads. Yeah.
That's true. There's not, it's also like, it does feel like the setup of this movie could have been like, oh, let's feel sorry for this, you know, affluent dude with a good job who, you know, is really just has a pretty plum deal to tap the book. Like, there's not a lot of sympathy you might have.
It's a story about another middle-aged white man kind of thing. Yeah.
But I think he's so... I don't think he's asking for sympathy.
No.
And the story isn't real. It's about him, but it's a layer of him. It's not. It's really about her and about these orchids and about adaptation as a theme, right? So I think it does work. It just looks very egotistical.
We haven't talked yet about his brother, Donald, who is also a parallel to him. He's like... He's sort of oafish and overly confident, and he decides that he also wants to become a screenwriter, just like his brother.
Yeah,
and
so the beginning of the movie. Yeah,
he starts to write, and he's got this like script that's a thriller, and it's called The Three, and it has this conceit where like the cop is also the killer and also the victim. Like this really stupid but very Hollywood idea.
Identity, wasn't that like the story of identity in the movie?
Yeah, exactly
that. When I saw the trailer for Split, this looks like Donald Kaufman's movie.
For sure.
But, you know, whereas Charlie struggles with every word, every page, Donald just, it seems to come so naturally to him. And, like, even when...
Everything does. Dating does.
Yeah, he, like, meets Maggie Gyllenhaal on the set of Being John Malkovich, and she's just enamored with him.
Yeah.
Charlie's agent loves his screenplay. He thinks it's like...
Yeah, Ron Livingston.
Yeah, it's going to make, like, the most money of anything that he's ever picked up.
Yeah.
And, like, all of this sends him into, like, a spiral. He doesn't know how to adapt the book. He can't figure out a way to do it. He even attends the Robert McKee seminar.
One of the best scenes in the movie.
Yeah, sure. Played by Brian Cox.
Yeah.
Who apparently was a friend of McKee's.
Wow.
Who suggested him for the part.
That's and looks eerily really like him, too.
Yeah. It's probably just him with like a wig or something.
That'd be a good performance. As Brian Cox, as Brian McKee.
Wait, Robert McKee.
I'm so confused there. That's how good it is.
You can tell them apart. Yeah.
It's like one of like Brian Cox's like best performances.
Yeah.
And we should mention, supposedly like all of this stuff happened. Like he did say that he went to the Robert McKee seminar and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they say that in the movie, like he halfway through the movie he starts writing the script that was the beginning of the movie. Like we kind of see
Yeah.
And I mean, adaptation itself, like, turns into a Robert McKee kind of, like, formula.
Yeah.
With, you know, how insane it gets.
Yeah, it itself adapts. Yeah.
Itself adapts.
It, like, goes against everything he says he wants to avoid about the movie, which is, you know, drug heist and sexiness and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that sexiness right after these messages.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Okay, we're back with Danita and Emily from the What About Meryl podcast. We said we were going to talk about sexiness. Blaine, you said you had something to say.
No, I was making a joke.
Well, I mean, we can't talk about this movie without talking about the sort of third act, which, like you said, becomes a McKee script, becomes like a Donald Kaufman type script.
Well, yeah.
And this is where like Meryl really shines too in this third act, because he starts kind of stalking Meryl a little bit with his brother. He brings his brother on board to write the script, and they go see her, and Donald kind of dresses up as Charlie to go see her and interview her.
Yeah.
It's a pretty funny scene too.
That scene's amazing. I love Nicolas Cage's acting in that scene, just while he's like listening.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
It bums me out that Nicolas Cage like has adaptation performances in him, but he does
so good.
He's so good,
and he disappears into the character.
Yeah, and he's so good as Donald. Like the character of Donald just makes me laugh so much. I love when he's like, "My movie's a thriller. What genre is yours?" Like just stuff like that is just like so funny.
To BuzzFeed quiz.
And you have to like reconcile in your mind that it's the same person. Like you kind of forget, like it's Lindsay Lohan in The Parent Trap. You know, like that's how I feel about this. Performance. I can't believe it's one person.
They have good chemistry together. Unlike we talked about Multiplicity a while ago with Michael Keaton, and it seemed like they didn't connect. But here, like, I totally felt like they were always in the same scene.
Yeah. I will say that, like, Spike Jonze has, like, a thing where he can, like, I guess he can, like, create chemistry between things that shouldn't have chemistry. Like, I always think about her and Joaquin Phoenix, who's amazing in it. But he has chemistry with a voice.
Yeah.
Like,
well, the voice wasn't even there the first time.
It's a different person's voice.
Spike Jonze just has, like, such a kinetic way of filming people, I think.
But, like, but Nicolas Cage really is able to, like, show you the difference between Donald and Charlie, like, with just the way that he acts. Like, there aren't a lot of differences in, like, their look or anything. No, like, you just know automatically. Like, you don't need somebody to say, oh, this is Donald. Like, hey, Donald. You know what I mean? Like, it's so automatic.
They breathe differently. It's in the eyes, honestly, because Donald has wider eyes.
Yeah.
And they breathe differently, and it's crazy.
I was reading an interview they did with Ebert at the time, and Ebert was saying Donald's got more hair, and it's like, no. Like, they're exactly the same.
Yeah.
And Spike Jonze was saying, like, you know, there's a scene where they're both sitting in a car, and you can tell right away before they say anything who's who.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you can tell in the script that Charlie Kaufman wrote it so that he'd be reminding you who was who when, like, when they got mixed up and they were running around, they got back in the car. He goes, "Donald, we have to get but you don't need that. You don't need the reminder. It's amazing.
Bring it back to Meryl a little bit again, because I do want to kind of think about this movie as a Meryl Streep movie also.
Yes, please.
Nicolas Cage podcast.
Because I love the twist, even though...
She hates Nicolas Cage.
I don't hate him. Like, who cares?
She doesn't care.
You know what I'll say? You know, as opposed to Meryl Streep, you expect Meryl Streep to be great. So you go in with like this, another great Meryl Streep performance in whatever this is. With Nicolas Cage, 9 times out of 10, you're going to get something batshit crazy.
He's going to yell at you
for
an hour. Yeah.
One time you're going to get
fingernails
brilliant.
At the screen.
Yeah.
No, but I loved the sort of third act where it becomes this other movie. A lot of people didn't like it. Watching it now with having Meryl in the back of my head the whole time, I was thinking, is it a problem that she was so much a sort of co-protagonist in the movie? Is it a problem that her character becomes so kind of surreal in the third act? Did that bother you at all?
I just think it's like a statement on like women's roles, that like the only way that she gets to play this like wild character is if this man writes this like wild fantasy for her. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And the fact that we think of it as like surreal and a fantasy means that like women aren't often given a chance to do that. You know, like, I mean, now we have like Atomic Blonde coming out next week where we have like Charlize Theron kicking ass and stuff. But like, I feel like we expect, especially in Meryl Streep, to like be the straight-laced Susan Orlean character, but I love that she gets to play this part. And I don't think it's a problem. I think it's actually pretty wonderful. And I think it's great that he let Susan be such a big part, because it really could just be a movie about Charlie, but he lets her have this juicy role. He lets her run around. He lets her have sex. He lets her like have that beautiful, like, I love the scene when she's like on the bed, and I've brought it up before, but I just think it's like a wonderful, wonderful Meryl moment. And, you know, I love the ending, and I'm so sad I missed it when I was younger, because I would have like lived for it. But it was also a fun surprise now to watch those scenes and like see her like having a blast. I think that's like one of the things we talk about a lot on the podcast, is like, I love when Meryl's having a blast, because you think like a lot of times she's like playing these really like stiff sort of like, as they like to say, icy characters, but like really she like
imbues a lot of personality and a lot of fun into her characters when she really wants to. And I think this is like a great example of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When she says we're going to have to kill him.
Yeah.
It's not just like God. Because Susan Orlean is saying that. Like, it's Meryl Streep saying that. And that catches you off guard
while
all the more.
She's considering it is amazing.
I know. I watched that moment. I rewinded that moment because it was like a masterclass in acting.
Yeah.
Like, because she's looking around, she's finding it, and then she finds it and her face drops. Yeah. And she
and I think
realizes
that's
what she has to do.
What makes this whole part work, because she is kind of playing like a shell person in a way, because she's playing almost a fictional character in, mm-hmm. in kind of the trajectory of the movie, but she plays it so real in scenes like that. That's I think that's why it works for me.
I think her character's arc is like really, I mean, we know that it parallels the Charlie Kaufman thing, but like it feels a lot more real, like her desire for something to find passion in. And you know, she tries to find it in LaRoche, but his interest, the way they like flitter from thing to thing, he's like, I said fuck fish. Done with fish.
Yeah, and the theme like permeates every level of the script. Like he's adapting all the, like he's changing all the time. Like it's amazing.
But the elusiveness of, I don't know, happiness or that thing that you long for.
Yeah, like I think LaRoche sort of brings like just such a spontaneity and like just excitement to her life that she didn't have before. Like you see her earlier in the film at the dinner scene at her apartment with, you know, just a bunch of like New York intellectuals. And it's just so interesting. Like that's kind of the life that's so many people dream of having, or like it's a life that people fantasize about, and it's so clear in that dinner scene. And she's walking when she leaves the table and walks to the bathroom, like there's a sense of like heaviness in that scene. And I don't know how Meryl portrayed heaviness, like an emotional heaviness, but well, she
and
does.
Bowling ball. And it's right after she like makes the joke in the doorway where he's like, oh, I'm going to tell the story anyway, and she like jumps up and down and goes, don't tell.
Like I just feel like so like, oh, like goosebumps when I'm talking about that scene. I love it so much. But yeah. I think LaRoche just brings like sort of just like a whole new world to her, and just like excitement, and she doesn't know what's going to happen. Yeah. And you know,
yeah. And Chris Cooper, he supports that character so well by being the opposite. And I think them acting together really made, and him sing too, right? Like they had each other, and I think that helped both of their performances.
I also like Chris Cooper as a parallel to Charlie Kaufman too, because he's like the exact opposite. He's like overly confident, but he's incompetent.
Right. Just like no self-awareness.
Yeah.
Which I think for Charlie Kaufman, like a person like LaRoche, like that is what you lust after. Like I know for me, I you know, I see people walking around just like so freely. I'm like, that would be so nice to like never worry about anything. You know? So like I think Charlie Kaufman is probably so fascinated by someone like LaRoche, because I think LaRoche really is a person like that.
Yeah.
You know, who's just
He says that he thinks he's the smartest person he knows, and he believes it.
It's a great line. Yeah, it lets you know everything you need to know about that character. Yeah.
So the third act is when it gets like batshit crazy, because this is the point where LaRoche sends Susan all these drugs. She starts doing the stuff that they refine from the ghost orchid plants. That's the reason that they were hunting it, not for its ephemeral beauty or whatever. It was because it could be used to get you high, which is beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's things set up that, like, you know, the guy who, like, loves her hair earlier in the movie, when it's not about drugs at all, and then it's like, oh, that's why he was acting so strange. So, so it kind of sets stuff up or turns things throughout the third act.
It's funny that it is, in a lot of ways, such a conventional script, even before it gets to the conventional bit. I don't mean conventional in terms of, like, its approach, because obviously it's very different, but in terms of, like, doing things like seeding in that they're going to do the drug thing later.
Yeah.
Like it, and it does have, you know, pretty solid structure. In a lot of ways, it's only structure at certain points. Like they're doing flashbacks within flashbacks. And
yeah, we see like the entire history of the universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And him being, or somebody being born.
But the weird thing is that most of the, I mean, you brought it up, Emily, but most of the women in this film are in fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of women who have dialogue hardly ever have it together.
Mm-hmm.
I think it passes the Bechdel test barely because Catherine Keener and Maggie Gyllenhaal have a conversation for a second, but I think it's like one word.
Well, what are they talking about?
Yeah, I don't even know.
They're talking about Dawn.
That doesn't pass the best show.
Yeah, it doesn't. So
I did like, I was watching this with my wife, and she pointed out that the scene where he fantasizes about going to the orchid show with Judy Greer, that Judy Greer is still wearing her waitress outfit. I couldn't even imagine a different set of clothes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've seen a lot of Charlie Kaufman's movies with women, and And sometimes, like, it does come up that maybe he does have, like, a problem writing women, or, like, he only sort of sees them through the lens of fantasy. I think that, like, in a way, he's, like, kind of, like, almost, like, disgustingly honest about how he views women sometimes in movies like Anomalisa or
Synecdoche,
New York. I mean, those are movies that are about, like, a white dude's anxiety so completely that, like, I think sometimes it's hard for maybe women in particular to be sort of let in. This movie sort of is maybe the exception because the Meryl Streep character is so strong. But then again, I didn't really remember being that strong the first time.
But it's like she becomes stronger when he's making it like a crazy thriller fantasy and applying the sort of like stereotypes and expectations of what a male character I think would do in those situations. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know that he's like writing it as like a great female character. He's writing it like how you would write any character in like a thriller. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's almost like kind of sad that it takes that for him to get to that sort of female character representation. But I do think like it's, I think it's his best female character that he's written for the screen. Like, that's my personal opinion. But maybe I'm biased because I love Meryl and I think she brings a great performance to it. And maybe that helps too, is like, Meryl takes it to the next level. If it was some other actress, I don't know if I would feel the same way about Susan Orlean on screen.
We talk a lot about how Meryl really, really just elevates anything she's in. We've watched some of her duds and we're like, even with anything, she just elevates any material. So I think Emily's right in that sense.
Yeah, and she can take kind of out there material and make it watchable and real. Like, this is kind of out there, and it's very watchable because of her. Same with Death Becomes Her and stuff, so.
I didn't think those were all fantasy sequences, like with her at the dinner party, going to the bathroom, or scenes of her writing.
Those are real.
But then Judy Greer, and then Tilda Swinton, and then her in the end being kind of a fantasy sequence in the end.
And like, I guess, not like that they're fantasies, but like the surrealism of the like ending sequences when she is like going to kill somebody, you know, like it's all in like a formulaic sort of setup, you know, of the thriller.
Yeah.
Like he lets her let go because it's supposed to be outrageous.
Right.
You know what I mean? As opposed to like, this is supposed to be real life.
Yeah, I think it was just sort of like a formula that he started following and just happened to be a woman in that character. Like, he could have plugged in anyone, but it just happened to be Susan Orlean.
It's so interesting, though, because Susan Orlean is writing about, I mean, predominantly orchids, but about LaRoche, right? Mm-hmm. In the Orchid Thief.
Yeah.
And then Charlie Kaufman is writing about her. So it's kind of a guy writing about a woman's story about a guy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very, and to make it a movie, a Hollywood movie, he has to change a woman's story that doesn't have a narrative into something that has like a very driven narrative and plot. So it, I don't know, it might be even a comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but you even said like her story is an adaptation of LaRoche's story.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
so, which is an adaptation of the Orchid story.
Which is an
the
adaptation.
Orchid sign off on this? Did they have to use a different name?
Yeah, the orchids are pissed.
It's like they're all connected.
They just want to grow on trees and everyone's cutting them down now because of this movie.
Oh yeah, probably. But this movie like devastated the orchid population in Florida.
We also didn't really talk about like the, they didn't really admit that Donald Kaufman wasn't a person when they were promoting this movie.
Yeah.
And like it's dedicated to his memory at the end.
He was nominated for an Oscar, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah. They had
for the screenplay.
Because the screenplay is credited to both, they had to nominate a fictional character for an Oscar.
He did, yeah.
And I don't know if you remember, I think the image they used was Charlie Kaufman and then just like a mirror image of the same photo.
I thought that was pretty brilliant.
Yeah.
I liked like the fun continuing of like the metatextual elements.
Yeah, I feel like that's a lot of Spike Jonze's influence too. Like I think he takes jokes too far. Mm-hmm. Like he does the Jackass stuff. Like I think he's in that world.
Right.
Well, for sure. That's why like they're like really perfect when they work together, Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze.
Just talking about that sort of like meta thing continuing, like I don't know if you guys ever saw the BAFTA Awards acceptance speech that Meryl did on behalf of Charlie Kaufman. No. Like it won best original screenplay or best adapted screenplay.
Adapted.
And so she had to read what he wrote for her and it was just like so great. Like you just have to watch it. But there's a great moment where she slips up, maybe because she's nervous because she doesn't know. I don't think she'd read what he had wrote. She just like read it out loud the first time.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I think she was kind of nervous being like, what is he going to make me say? But she gets a little nervous and she says, I'd like to spank instead of thank. And it's like this amazing moment. Crack in the Meryl Streep, you know, facade. So anyways, you guys should definitely watch it.
Wow.
Which I was like, And also, in a lot of interviews, Meryl was like, she thought that Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze were really hip, cool guys. So she was really intimidated to work on this movie because she thought they were, like, so cool and, like, out there, which I just think is, like, adorable because I was like, they're the least hip, cool guys.
They're, like, huge nerds.
That's great. I don't know. Like, Spike Jonze directed Beastie Boys videos.
Yeah, but he, hip. He talks like, he's kind of a nerd, which I like.
You wouldn't cast him as a cool guy. You wouldn't cast him as Fonzie or something.
Would you cast him in like Three Kings?
Yeah, it's like the Weasley little.
He has a gun.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know.
Yeah, we should put the Baptist speech up on Facebook.
You should.
Yeah, okay, we'll do that.
It's
yeah,
that's so fun. Good.
Yeah.
I did want to talk a little bit about some of the other Meryl Streep movies you guys have been watching, because you've been rewatching tons of Meryl movies for your podcast. Were there any that stood out as better than you thought they'd be or worse than you thought?
For me, and I'm honestly, all I do is talk about She-Devil since we watched it months ago. You guys laugh, but it's so good. And like, listeners, please go and watch She-Devil. It has such a bad reputation, but Susan Seidelman, the director, just like, it's just such a cool movie. It looks cool, and it's by women, for women, starring women, and it's like subversively feminist in ways that like is so ahead of its time. Like it's sort of like the first Wives Club, but I don't want to say better because my other love is Bette Midler.
But with Lucifer.
It is sort of like a precursor to the first Wives Club, and it's like, you know, 6 or 7 years prior, and when I saw it, I just, because I hadn't seen it since I was a kid, and it just like blew my head off because my expectations were so low, and I was like, this is the coolest movie. And when we screened it at the Royal back in May, and everyone kind of coming out of the theater was like, wow, that was so much better than we remember.
Wow.
So it was just such a cool
Rewatchable is what you're saying.
It's so rewatchable.
Okay. Yeah. It's based on a novel too,
yeah, by
it?
Faye Weldon, and it's such a cool book.
I guess the movie that surprised me the most is Silkwood, because I'd never actually watched it, and oh my god, I'm literally obsessed with it. I bring it up all the time, but like, I'm also like a sucker for like real life stories about women that try really hard and then like struggle. Like, I was obsessed with Erin Brockovich when it came out.
Oh,
I
such a good movie, though.
I just was like obsessed with it. I know they're both real life stories, so I think that like imbues me to it too, but like Silkwood, Cher plays a like lesbian, her like roommate who's like a cool lesbian. Kurt Russell's like really hot in it, and as always, but he's also the supporting character in it, which I love. And Meryl's just like so badass and like wearing like cowboy boots and skirts, and the story is just incredible. And it's also a mystery too. I don't know if you guys know the story about Karen Silkwood, but it's like, it's just exceptional. And she's also really cool in it. And I, going back to this like hip cool thing, I think people don't think of Meryl being hip or cool, but I think she really can play that in addition to playing the like, you know, doubt character or like Sophie's Choice. Also, Sophie's Choice, I know there's like so many jokes about Sophie's Choice and whatever, but like honestly, she's incredible in it.
Yeah, I think that one surprised both of us. I had seen it a couple times before I rewatched it for the podcast, and I in general just like kind of stay away from movies about war and just like really sad things. And so I told Emily, like, I had to confess that I like fast forwarded through some of the Holocaust scenes because it's just too much for me. But we were telling the guys downstairs, like, she invented acting with Sophie's Choice. When you rewatch that, you're just like, she is doing so many things on so many different layers. Like, it's just incredible what she does in that movie. And so it's just brilliant to watch. But I also think, like, doing this podcast, she does have those kind of like heavy-handed films like Out of Africa or even something like A Sophie's Choice or Ironweed, but she also like had a lot of fun over the years, and I think that's what people forget, so that's been a really nice surprise for us.
But if you had to pick between Sophie's Choice and one of the other movies. No, I'm stuck.
That's a real choice.
I was ready to pick.
did you guys do Angels in America?
No.
Okay, so that's like we're trying to decide how to do that because she plays multiple
three parts.
Yeah, and there's four parts to the series?
More.
Okay.
It's like a six-part miniseries.
Yeah, very long.
So we're trying to figure out if we should do like two-parter episode or one episode on each one, because we just do one movie like you guys do, one movie per episode. So we're trying to figure it out. But we want to do it because it's like...
It's incredible.
It's an incredible performance.
She's great.
Yeah.
Doesn't she play like a rabbi?
Yeah, she plays like an old rabbi and like a Mormon mom and probably some angel or some shit.
Yeah, apparently like we had Johanna Schneller on our adaptation episode, actually. She loves adaptation. And she interviewed Meryl at the ROM, like, when was it? How many years ago?
Like 2007.
2007.
Ellie and I were both there.
Yes. We didn't know each other at the time. But Johanna, like, put together a package of clips of Meryl. And one of the clips was Meryl as a rabbi. And the guy that was, like, running the AV was like, this isn't a Meryl Streep clip. Is this the wrong clip? And,
right? I didn't know, like, the first four times I watched that movie.
That's clearly screen legend Judd Hirsch. Accidentally put him there. Yeah, that's funny. And we were talking before the podcast about the movie The River Wild, which I loved as a kid. And I just realized that was directed by Curtis Hanson, who plays her husband in adaptation.
Whoa.
Oh, we didn't. I don't know if we ever knew that.
Meta.
That's great.
That's so cool.
The River Wild is interesting. I think you guys would all like it. And, like, I don't know if it would hold up to your expectations.
Yeah, maybe not.
But I feel like for a first watch for you guys, it might be cool because it's, like, Meryl's only, like, real, like, thriller aside from the end of adaptation, I guess. But it's her only, like, real thriller, and she really brings it. Like, she looks strong. She is strong. She, like, goes up against Kevin Bacon, and John C. Reilly also is the other guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool. Scary John C. Reilly or funny John C. Reilly?
No, scary. Creepy.
And her husband is David Strathairn, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So cute in it. Like, it really awakened something in me. But I had never seen it. And it was when I was going through sort of Meryl's filmography in high school. I was like, this seems so stupid. It's not really, like, I love thrillers, but I thought it was more like action versus thriller. And I don't care about Kevin Bacon. I'm so sorry.
He's actually a listener, so cut that out.
Yeah. We're at least 6 degrees from him right
but
now.
But I was so pleasantly surprised by this film. So that was another really kind of fun one. And actually, I told Emily when we were recording that I feel like I've just spent my whole life watching movies, and sometimes I feel like there's not a lot left. Like, I'm not going to discover that much that, like, is new for me. And so the fact that I had this, like, hidden gem of a Meryl movie after, you know, 20 years of watching Meryl Streep movies, I, like, got a little emotional when she came on screen because I was like, this is beautiful. It's like a new, like, obviously Meryl's going to make more movies, but to sort of have one to go back and discover that I had never seen, it was like uncovering, like, a vault or something. Like, it was the best.
Did you guys read that article? I can't remember if it was new or whether it was just sort of like brought back on long form, but it was about Meryl Streep while she was filming Kramer versus Kramer and how Dustin Hoffman was a dick. But it was also just after her then boyfriend, the guy who played Fredo Corleone, died.
John Cazale.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
That's a good article.
We talked in depth about that for our Kramer versus Kramer episode, which sort of upset Emily's mom.
Oh my God. So my mom was supposed to be on the episode because, like, it's like one of her favorite movies. She's talked about it since I was a kid. So I was like, I'm going to bring her on. Also, she's a mom. We're not moms, so we can't bring that perspective to the movie and to the character of Johanna. So we were like, okay, let's bring her on. She couldn't come on because my brother ended up in the hospital. So I recorded a little segment
with
her.
And she abandoned him.
Yeah, she did. No, but we recorded a little segment with her, and she hadn't listened to what we said until the episode came out. And then she was like, I was really offended by what you said about Dustin. And I was like, well, it was a fact that was reported by Vanity Fair. And, like, so she still has a thing for Dustin, but, like, you know.
I mean, we, like, it was problematic faves, but, like, Dustin Hoffman is really cute in it. So, you know, it's just one of those things that's like, maybe dudes should just stop ruining things for us. Yeah. You know?
A PSA for all actors out there. Yeah. Hey, dudes, stop ruining shit.
Well, but the big thing that happened, and you mentioned John Cazale, like, he used the fact that John Cazale, like, Meryl's partner, had died to get an emotional response out of her, which is such a dick move. Oh, like, you know? So, and it's like, oh, you don't believe that this girl, I guess she was new to the industry at the time, but you don't believe that she can elicit that response on her own. Like,
yeah.
You know, I don't know if we're allowed to swear on this, but like, fuck you.
No.
Yeah. Like, you know.
You can now.
Yeah, well, I just did.
Sort of fuck you, Dustin Hoffman. You're still one of the greatest actors ever.
Yeah, but you're a fucking asshole.
It just sort of took a lot of agency away from like Meryl's own performance. And not that we're talking about Kramer versus Kramer in this episode, but I mean, one of the end scenes in court, everyone was struggling with Joanna's kind of last speech. And Meryl went in to sort of like her hotel room and just wrote something down, and it was perfect. And Dustin Hoffman like held a lot of animosity towards her because of that, because he had tried to write something and it didn't work. Mm. So there's a lot of sort of really interesting stuff about that movie.
Well, he was a listener too, but I guess
there's another one gone.
It's his own fault.
Well, let's wrap up here and let's go around and see if this movie was rewatchable for you, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like it has like some structural like unsteadiness at points. Like it's sort of slow at points, but I think it's such like a well written movie, and I think all the characters, I think they really like feed off each other in like a really great way, and it becomes like such a big cohesive statement. And it even like it's really brilliant in the way that it succeeds by failing, or like lets itself succeed by failing, like in that third act becoming like the thriller or whatever. So I love this movie. It's totally rewatchable, and I got so much, you know, more from it watching it again this time. So I'll watch it again probably soon.
Great. What about you, Jam?
Yeah, I really like this movie. I continue to like it. It's not my favorite of the Charlie Kaufman ones. I think I probably like Synecdoche, New York more. But yeah, it was really good.
Really?
Yeah,
that's like the most depressing movie. Like that's up there with Requiem for a Dream for me. Like I don't know if I can watch it again.
Yeah. Oh, I've only seen it once.
It like depressed me for months afterwards.
I bought the DVD and will never watch it. Yeah, and I don't think we talked too much about the twin stuff, but in kind of mentioning what we were saying before about how it is kind of like it has those script devices even before it's kind of acknowledging that it's using like some McKee-like tricks. Okay. And I think the twin thing is kind of a brilliant construct in that vein. Like it's how does he tell that story about him grappling with things by himself? You can't do it. He has to, like, he literally uses like multiple personalities to tell the story. And I think the fact that he's doing that the whole time without even like tipping his hand.
Well, he confuses you because he uses the voiceover. So you're like, that's how he grapples with himself. But really, it's the brothers.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, that's what I mean. It's like, it's not a lack of structure, which is what he's kind of sending out to do. It's almost like too much structure. Like he has there's too much going on.
It's like a writing magic trick. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah.
No, I think it's a great movie, and I'll definitely watch it again.
Okay. What about you, Emma?
I definitely think it's a rewatchable movie. I mean, I've only watched it two times now. Well, I guess one and a half times. But I would definitely rewatch it, even just for Meryl, because I also think, like, in Meryl's trajectory, like, she had done Music of the Heart right before this, and then after, she got to do a lot of diverse, really interesting stuff. So I really thank this movie for, I think, showing people a different side of Meryl. Mm-hmm. And also, I just think it's a fun movie to watch, especially if you're a writer, because you can just relate to it. So I would definitely rewatch it.
Danita?
I also would rewatch it. While watching it last night, I was like, this is a movie that just gets more and more fun the more times you watch it. And that's what I love about great movies, you know, and I just think this is a great movie. And I agree with Emily that it's just an interesting point in Meryl's career. Like, she was a middle-aged actress and she could have never worked again, you know, in this kind of like the early 2000s. And she just sort of, it just sort of kickstarted like the, you know, the Meryl we know now. So, you know, I think it's a special
the
movie.
The new Meryl Nilum.
Right.
She probably thought she was going to get to kill someone when she signed up for Music in the Heart. It's a Wes Craven movie.
Right. Oh, we talked about that in the Music of the Heart.
Love that movie, by the way. You should all watch it.
I've seen it.
I'm on board with everyone else. I think it's a really eminently rewatchable movie and so much fun because of Meryl Streep. She really brings it. Thank you both for coming on the podcast and talking about Meryl with us.
Thks for having us. We love bringing Meryl to the masses. As we say,
Meryl to the masses. And you can check out your guys' podcast at whataboutmeryl.com and on iTunes. Is that sorry,
yeah?
Is that
the well, I don't know if we have a whataboutmeryl.com, but
I just gave them a domain. Yeah, I just gave you a domain name if you want one.
We're on Facebook. Okay. We're on Twitter. We're on Tumblr. Emily usually does this at the end of our episode, this is exciting. Yeah. We're on everywhere.
You're adapting to our
social
podcast.
Media, and
we're on iTunes,
Stitcher, and SoundCloud.
Great. So, yeah. Awesome. Well, you can also find our podcast on all those sites too, at rewatchability.com, facebook.com/rewatchability, and on Twitter at rewatchability. And you can also help us out by going to patreon.com/rewatchability and giving us a few bucks per month, foregoing a coffee once a month and helping us keep the lights
Don't
on.
Make them forego a coffee, because people need a coffee.
I need a coffee.
Well, the third coffee then. Maybe the third coffee after 3 p.m.
Learn to do that
anyway. Learn to adapt. Thank you so much for listening.
Imagine me and you. I do. Come on. I think about you day and night. It's only right. Come on. Sing with me. To think about the one you love and hold her tight. So happy together. What the
hell? Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.